Hi, Matt.
How are you today?
You know, I'm doing well. It's been a big policy week, and this is my first time on This Week in Blog, and I'm very excited for it.
Well, thank you for being here. Welcome. And why don't you tell everybody a little bit about you and what you do?
I am an editor at Foreign Policy and a writer at Foreign Policy, so I write a bit about a lot of things, basically, and I'm also a blogger for Passport, which is Foreign Policy's blog.
Very good, very good. Well, I guess the big topic that we at least have to start off talking about a little bit here is healthcare, because we have to be a little bit careful, because once again, I always say this, but it's such a stuff is breaking constantly, and by the time this airs, who knows what might have happened. But I guess at this point, how do you think it's going, and what do you see happening in the progressive blogosphere?
Well, I think that you see basically glee and delight in the progressive blogosphere. I'm very bullish on this passing or starting to pass this weekend. Obviously, there's a bunch of votes, but I think as soon as Nancy Pelosi has those votes, she's going to wait for the sort of 72 hours, which, the CBO score came out today, said they were going to wait 72 hours and then they would vote through the Demon Pass. Basically, they would say that they've passed the Senate bill and then they would pass the fixes to it. And so I think that in the progressive blogosphere, you've seen, it's been funny because there hasn't been a long time that I think people have been really hopeful about this passing. And then all of a sudden it's here, and it's like, as of this weekend, the biggest hurdle might actually be over. They might actually pass this thing into law, like sort of, before Easter, which is crazy.
It is interesting, this kind of reminds me of the line from the famous movie Fletch, where he goes to the hospital. He's pretending to be a doctor, and Chevy Chase. No, he Chevy Chase goes to a doctor trying to find out information about somebody, and the doctor says, "Well, the guy died." And Chevy Chase is like, "Oh my God, it's so sudden!" And the guy's like, "Well, he's had cancer for 2 years." And Chevy Chase is like, "Yeah, but the very end was very sudden." And I kind of feel like that's how this is. I mean, this should have passed last summer. But you're right, the fact that it may be imminent now does seem sudden. So.
And, I think that also progressive bloggers are starting to realize. I mean, the big thing that I don't want to think about, but I do think people are thinking about, is if the votes don't materialize, if this gets pushed off even further, which I think that basically it wouldn't die so much as it would get pushed off again. I think that you'll see basically horror from the progressive blogosphere and a lot of claims that people are moving to Canada and stuff like that. So how do you think the response from the conservative blogosphere has been? Because it seems to me that it's focused a lot on the details of passage as opposed to the bill itself at this point.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, at this point, it is the way that Democrats are going about trying to pass it. I'm looking at a couple posts right here. Red State's, well, I guess Heritage, he works at Heritage Foundation, but he's writing at Red State. Brian Darling talking about the slaughter bill. Leon H. Wolf at Red State also writing, "As the Obamacare debate nears to close, it is looking increasingly likely that the House will attempt to use the blatantly unconstitutional slaughter solution to, quote,
Blatantly
deem
unconstitutional.
the Senate bill already passed through the House." I guess it'll be up to the Supreme Court if it passes to determine if it's unconstitutional, but I think we can all agree that the fact that it definitely doesn't look good to the American people that they may pass this hugely, hugely important bill, and we've been, again, talking about it for a year now, without actually voting on it in the House, deeming it passed. So I do think that a lot of the process has fueled a lot of the blogging talk this week on the right.
Well, and I think it's interesting because I think that the progressive blogosphere has done a great job of saying, look, the Republicans are much better at passing things through kind of procedurally tricky ways than the Democrats are. They use Demon Pass something like 30 times. They use reconciliation for Bush tax cuts, all sorts of other bills. And so, to say that basically to actually use Senate procedures and sorry, not just Senate, but congressional procedures to pass things is somehow unconstitutional or illegal. I don't think that they've done a very good job on pushing back on that. I don't think that you've seen Nancy Pelosi and other people coming out and really explaining that this is not actually as terrible as people sound, because, you know, what they're trying to do is, you know, the House has already passed a bill, the Senate has already passed a bill, those two bills are pretty close to each other, just really trying to push this across the finish line without, you know, without messing everything up. And so I think that you've seen people, you know, you've seen Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias and sort of the folks over at the American Prospect making this argument. None of this is that weird. But I think that there's been a real failure of communication. And I think that the conservative blogosphere has taken this up really, really well as a cudgel.
I agree. I think that the conservative blogosphere has done a very good job. I think it's an easy argument to make that this is unfair or that this seems heavy-handed. And you see things like Denis Kucinich being flown on Air Force One and changing his vote. And it's very reminiscent of the Cornhusker kickback. So I do agree with you that conservatives have probably been more effective at communicating it. But it seems like the Democrats' arguments are more nuanced or more, you know, sort of in the weeds. Whereas it's easier to essentially say, look, Denis Kucinich was against the bill. He flew in Air Force One. 2 days later, he's for the bill. You fill in the dots. So I think that that's part of it as well. The other thing that I do think's ironic is that, you know, you were saying how progressives kind of said, well, look how Republicans pushed bills through. The irony is that modern day conservatives, and I'll speak for myself, but don't really, they don't look back at those days with relish. We actually look at that as a bad thing. And so it's not like, it's not a matter of hypocrisy. Conservatives are saying that was horrible when Republicans did that too. But the irony is that liberals are who decried the heavy-handed tactics of Republicans, I guess in the 2000s, in the aughts, are now seeking to emulate those and say, well, we need to be tough like the Republicans were.
Yeah. You know, I do think that that's true. And you know what I think is so interesting and has been like one of the more delightful things about this? You know, I think Denis Kucinich is not my favorite member of Congress. You know, I can name a lot of things that I think Denis Kucinich has done that have been pretty terrible or stupid. And, you know, but what he got, so the Cornhusker kickback that everybody was so upset about was a huge deal, right? You know, it was to create special rates for an entire state but not give those rates to the rest of the country for Medicare. It seems that what Denis Kucinich got in exchange for his vote is a ride on Air Force One and his wife to promote her vegetarian agenda, which just delights me. But you know, it might end up that Denis Kucinich actually got something like more major in return for his vote, but like, you know, it's a huge bill and he got, you know, his wife to promote vegetarianism. It's one of the more delightful weirdnesses of how this has gone through.
And you know the old joke, it's we've already established what you are, now we're just haggling over the price. So, but you're right, I think Denis Kucinich could have gotten a lot more out of it. So, but here's the thing about Denis Kucinich, and everybody has something that makes them tick, right? Like some people, what makes them tick is money. What makes Denis Kucinich tick is publicity and attention. That's why the guy ran for president twice. So President Obama was exactly right. If he had promised to give him some sort of, you know, a bridge in Ohio, Kucinich probably wouldn't have cared. But if you let him have a big press conference and a ride on Air Force One, now you're talking, you know, now his ears are going to perk up. So.
Yeah, it's been one of the funnier things about it. And so what do you think the reaction from conservatives is going to be when this passes? Because my guess is that people have, you know, basically started strategizing how that's going to impact, you know, elections sort of 8 months from now. And so what's the response going to be?
Well, it is a little premature to say that it passed, but I'll hypothetically, let's say that the bill did pass or does pass.
Let's say, I guess so. Touch wood on my side. You don't have to.
if the bill does pass, I think that you will see an immediate campaign to repeal it. And this won't be limited to the conservative blogosphere. This will be 435 House races, you know, however many governorships are up, however many U.S. Senate seats are up, I guess a third of them. It's especially the targeted ones. That will be, this is, it's too late for anything else to be the defining issue. Healthcare is the defining issue of the 2010 midterm elections. And I know that it's commonly thought, at least by Democrats, that they'll fare better by passing something. I think it's pretty much a wash. I think if they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't at this point. I think if healthcare passes, there is going to be such an incredible anger and energy coming from conservatives that I think will and they're going to run on repeal it. It's going to be that becomes they no longer are the party of no. They're now the party of yes, which yes, we're going to repeal it. So who needs a contract with America 2.0? As I've written about before, advocating for that, they'll have one thing on their contract, repeal Obamacare.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though, because for them to run on wanting to repeal Obamacare before basically any provisions, you know, I think there's a couple little things that come into effect immediately, right? So you can get COBRA until you're 26 and a couple other little things. But the really big stuff doesn't come into effect until, like, 2014, right? As of 2014, you can't be denied coverage for pre-existing condition, blah, blah, blah. Or 2013. I'm probably messing up the details a little bit. But, you know, this is maybe going to be a pretty big test of the mettle of the Republicans, right? Because they're going to have to actually come up with ideas for better solutions. Because, you know, this bill, it covers 31 million people and it reduces the deficit. That was a really high bar that, you know, Democrats set for themselves, and they've jumped over it.
I'm skeptical that it would actually reduce the deficit. But I do think that you're right. I mean, that if Republicans have a chance to repeal it, they're going to have to act quick, because once people become part of an entitlement program, it becomes politically very difficult, as we've seen, to roll back anything like that. So it will be interesting, but really, I think regardless of whether or not Republicans are able to roll it back, 2010, they'll have that energy on their side. Now, if Republicans get in office and act like they did last time, I don't think it's going to take 10 years for them to be ousted again. It could be a very short-lived time in power. But in any event, you know, we could probably talk all day about healthcare, but unfortunately, some of what we say may be defunct or outdated by the time this airs, which is usually about a day after we record it. So let's move on to a very nice segue, which does involve healthcare, but it's not going to change because it already happened, and that's President Obama's appearance with Bret Baier on Fox News. It was interesting. Yeah. Today I heard Rush Limbaugh say that, why did President Obama go on Fox News? He said it's because more people watch the cartoon channel than watch MSNBC or CNN. So in any event, what was your take, and what are you hearing from progressive bloggers about that appearance yesterday?
Well, I think you saw a lot of progressive bloggers basically saying that this was offensive, you know, wouldn't let the president get his points out. There was a lot of focusing on the interrupting. So the constant kind of interruption, wouldn't let Obama talk, you know, really irritated Obama visibly starting from the very, very beginning of the interview. So the interview was pretty long. It was like 20 minutes long or so. And you know, just kind of kept on, you know, basically cutting into his answers to the questions. Obviously, the very first question was about Demon Pass and you know, never got to an answer. And so I think that was kind of the response of the liberal blogosphere. But, you know, I actually come down on the side of saying that, you know, why not harass the president about a major, major initiative? Yeah. You know, I think it's probably – Obama is good when he's feisty. and the weird thing is there wasn't that much – news broken in the interview. I didn't think that the interview itself was very good. And it just doesn't bother me when people sort of, you know, try and question these great powers. So what was the response in the conservative blogosphere?
Well, first of all, let me say, I agree with you as someone who does interview people for my podcast, and for other stuff. I completely agree with you. I also am very sympathetic of interviewers, because people don't realize how challenging it is. And I also have to say, I was impressed by how other people, including David Schuster on MSNBC, essentially argued that, yeah, this is good. We should challenge presidents. I found that to be more interesting than conservatives, who you would expect to say what I'm about to read. A guy named Seth Leibson, L-E-I-B-S-O-H-N, at the Corner, National Review's The Corner, said of Bear, he was resilient in the face of the president's obvious attempts to run down the clock by stonewalling. Brett continually hammered a series of questions the president did not want, and yet he was polite in explaining to the president the meaning of the questions, just in case they were not what the president was familiar with. It was a model of how not to be cowed by a strong and charismatic leader, and a model of a truly independent anchor reporter. Roger L. Simon at Pajamas Media said there's no way Barack Obama would have appeared on Fox Wednesday night in a sit-down interview with Brett Baer had the president's health care bill not been in serious trouble. Had not the president's health care bill been in serious trouble. And then Ed Morrissey over at Hot Air said, Brett Hume rightly praises Baer's work, as he did do a good job of refusing to let Obama off the hook for his non-answers and clearly annoyed Obama because of that. Don't be too surprised when people take that annoyance as an affront to the dignity of the office, which is exactly the wrong impulse. So those were the predictable responses, but I think they're right on in this case.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I don't think that any of those critiques are quite right. You know, it seems to me that the president's health care initiative is not that badly imperiled at this point. It's been closer to passage than it ever has been, and looks like it will pass. And, you know, in terms of, because I guess it was Keith Olbermann on MSNBC who really, really went after this interview as being sort of offensive. But it's actually been surprising to see a pretty, you know, that being a sort of a partisan fringe opinion, that people can't ask Barack Obama tough questions,
right,
and that it's inappropriate to sort of stop somebody. Because I think that you're right that, you know, basically, it's really, really difficult to get anything out of politicians. They're impossible
yeah.
to interview.
They're trained to
and
not
so, you
say
know,
anything interesting. Or to here's the problem
yeah.
too. They could just start talking and talk for 10 minutes, and then what? And then
oh,
what
yeah.
do you do?
I mean, very good at it.
If you don't interrupt them, so it's tough.
Yeah. So I mean, I agree, and I think that it was interesting. So what do you think the sort of strategy really of Obama? You know, so you mentioned the blog post in which somebody said, you know, he was doing this because Fox News has all of these viewers. But what do you think of this sort of, like, reach across to Fox News viewers, or at least stereotyped as being sort of, you know, on the right?
Yeah, it is interesting because the numbers that I've seen, I mean, Fox doesn't just beat the other cable networks. They blow them out of the water. It's unbelievable,
mm-hmm.
the ratings. And, in fact, I believe it's true that more people watch Fox than watch CNN, CNN Headline News, MSNBC, C-SPAN, and a couple other similar channels put together, combined. So I
yeah.
And also I've seen numbers, you know, that yes, more conservatives watch Fox, but actually more, and if you're talking about just numbers, like just sheer numbers of people, there are actually more liberals who watch Fox than liberals who watch MSNBC.
Wow, I didn't know that actually.
Just because of the sheer numbers. So even though it might only be
sure.
even though it might only be 30 or 40% of probably 30% of Fox's viewers are liberal, that number is actually larger.
Right.
than it. So in any event, I think that I think it speaks more to how large their audience is. Because remember, Valerie Jarrett, you know, not that long ago was saying that Fox News is the house organ of the Republican Party. And I guess, was it John Edwards refused to go on Fox during the campaign? So maybe this is just a signal that that the war, that sort of war between, and wasn't it Gibbs, Robert Gibbs, didn't he basically say that they weren't a news operation?
He did.
So maybe this is a signal, if nothing else, that war has ended and that, you know, it is a place to go to get your message out.
And you know, I think it would be stupid for the White House to say. So I think that we've seen over the past year that basically the progressives and Democrats believe that, you know, any sort of negotiation with the other side has been futile and time wasting. That, you know, basically it was the sort of old Charlie Brown thing of, you know, here I'll hold the ball and
right.
then they, you know, pull it away, right?
Well, I mean, there was a time during this whole Fox debate, there were conservative
uh-huh.
bloggers saying that the Obama administration takes a harder line stance against Fox than they do against Iran. You know, they're willing
yeah.
to talk and negotiate with them, but they won't talk to Fox, so.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that to a certain extent, it would be simplistic to say that just because, you know, basically Senate Democrats futility of negotiation with Senate Republicans, you know, has kind of made people in the progressive blogosphere real fed up. You know, the White House wouldn't reach out across the line to Fox News, which, you know, because of its size, maybe is so moderate. And, you know, actually, I have to admit that I, like, never watch it. I don't watch TV very much, you know, basically news on TV very much anyway. And so I didn't, you know, I don't watch Fox that much, so I have trouble almost, like, figuring out exactly, like, where the characterization comes from.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm all for, you know, Obama reaching out and being on Fox as often as possible, especially because I think Obama came off well in that interview. It wasn't like he got sandbagged.
Yeah, yeah. And my criticism of Fox, of course, is not that they are conservative-leaning, because I think that there's obviously it's a free market and they're serving a niche and doing quite well. My criticism of Fox is that they – put Kid Rock on as a political analyst, you know. But anyway, so speaking of cable news and the sort of cable news wars, and also the blogosphere, it is the Weekend Blog. Big story this week, which came out, was that Red State's Eric Erickson, who is I guess the top editor at Red State, is now a contributor for CNN. And this struck me as huge because I don't think it got the attention it deserved. I mean, we've had journalists, like traditional journalists from like the New York Times become political pundits, or we've seen former politicians or former campaign strategists. But I think this is the first time we've had, you know, I mean, I guess Fox has like Mary Catherine Hamm and Amanda Carpenter who are analysts, but this is a big, big deal with CNN, and he's on with John King. So I think this is a big stepping stone for bloggers.
Yeah. I mean, so I think that that's true, and I definitely think that you're seeing a lot more bloggers on television. And if you watch MSNBC, you know, during Olbermann and Maddow and all these other sort of headlining shows, it's basically just chock full of bloggers.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like the bloggers are outnumbering the sort of traditional old media people. So I agree with you that you've seen this tremendous, like, sort of drift of bloggers to be, you know, really respected as pundits also. And also I think that you've seen a lot more fluidity. So like Amanda Carpenter, who you mentioned, I'm pretty sure she works for Jim DeMint now.
Right.
She's actually gone back over to the Hill and, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see her kind of, you know, move back out into the commentary space, eventually. But, you know, this surprised me because, you know, so the progressive blogosphere was up in arms because Eric Erickson has said a lot of dumb stuff, you know, the sort of like typical bottom of the barrel, calling feminists feminazis, suggesting that Obama should be death paneled. You can kind of go through just a long litany of these. There's, you know, he used an extremely naughty term for a retiring Supreme Court justice, which I won't use in case there are children watching. But, you know, I think that part of it didn't bother me so much. You know, I think that bloggers kind of say stupid things or whatever. I think the bigger sin here is that I've never really gotten the impression that Eric Erickson is all that impressive as a political commentator. And I don't know if you can speak to, you know, maybe he's some great light that I just don't know about, but I can't recall a time where I was really convinced by an Eric Erickson argument or sort of impressed by how deeply sourced he was, for instance.
I think he's very – well, first of all, I like Eric a lot. I've known Eric for years. He is really one of the good guys, regardless of political philosophy. He's a really good guy, very caring guy, very sincere guy. One of the few people I probably would really trust in this business, a very good guy. He's very smart. He's very sharp. I think he was an attorney before becoming a full-time blogger. And he's very quick, very quick-witted, which comes in handy. You know, look, there's different skill sets.
He's funny. He's, that's true.
Yeah, and you could be like, you know, I think I go on TV as well, but I think I'm maybe a better writer in the sense that, like, you know, I think there's a skill set where you really parse words and try to get things to be exactly precise and you take time. And then you present your product to the world when it's finished. And I kind of like that, as opposed to being on the spot, whether it's blogging or tweeting or on national television. I think Eric's very good on TV. He's obviously different than me stylistically. I mean, part of his shtick is to get people's attention and to say things that could be a little bit outrageous, and hopefully that gets people thinking. And sometimes you have to be that way. You have to be a little controversial to get people's attention in this day and age. So I think he's very good, and I'm not just saying that because I like him personally. I think he's very good on CNN when I've seen him.
I mean, and I guess that it's true. So I think the person who laid out the progressive case against Eric Erickson best was probably Kevin Drum, who sort of did the legwork to say, okay, these are, or it was Kevin Drum and Steve Bannon, actually, also a Political Animal, basically said, you know, he said all of these kind of offensive things, and there may be some other bright lights from the conservative blogosphere who would be better than Eric Erickson. And so how do you think the reaction was, like, on the conservative side? Do you think people were surprised by this? You know, because I definitely think that liberals basically glommed onto the fact that he said some stuff that they consider really deeply offensive.
Right, well, I think liberals don't like it when conservatives become part of the mainstream. So a few years ago, a blogger named Ben Domenech got a gig as a Washington Post blogger. And within a week, he was gone. The left went after him. Apparently, they dug up stuff, allegations of plagiarism. In any event, he was gone within a week. And I think that, you know, sort of a similar thing may be happening with Eric, although I don't think it's going to work. I think if it was going to work, it would have worked by now. But you know, in terms of conservatives' reactions, I saw a lot of people congratulating him, like on Twitter. I've not seen a lot of blogging about it. I think Dan Reel wrote something congratulating him. I think Mo Lane at Red State wrote something congratulating him. But I think that most, you know, Eric's very popular among conservatives. The funny thing is, and by the way, I'll tell you one of the reasons I really like Eric Erickson, and I think he's indispensable, is his guts and his willingness to go after the Republican establishment. I have a real problem with a lot of the committee people, the Republican Party apparatus, the establishment, and a lot of people are a little bit afraid of them, and Eric Erickson, day in and day out, goes after them. I think that's more of a service, arguably, than what he says against Democrats. And so I really admire him for that, and I think he's become indispensable for that reason. And I think that he's very well liked among conservatives. But I would say this. I haven't seen evidence of this, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of jealousy among some or sour grapes that he's getting the gig. You know, I'm sure a lot of people would posture themselves as getting it, and he got it. So I haven't seen anybody express that, but it would be human nature for people to – I mean, look, I've always viewed it as like sort of the rising tide lifts all the boats, you know, that if what's good for him is good for me. But it wouldn't surprise me if some bloggers out there wish that it had been them instead of him.
Yeah. Well, I do think that in the liberal blogosphere, there was a little bit of, like, sort of confusion at him being sort of hired first or something into a big place like that. There was a bit of surprise. You know, I think, again, because he had made these sort of impolitic statements, and I think it's pretty clear that you know, basically what CNN was saying was, we know that he did this. Like, you know, you can't dig up anything that he said that it was offensive because we know all about it, because I presume that they'd seen all that. And they said, you know, we still value his political analysis and everything else, and we're going to hire him. And so I think that what was maybe interesting is that you didn't see some of, like, the, you know, that they hired him, like, for being a partisan and for being sort of like a firecracker and whatever else it was. And there was sort of just no apology made about the fact that he had, in characteristic blogger style, made some, like, fairly offensive comments before. So do you think that kind of, you know, creates some hope for people who really do have sort of sharp elbows and are used to really getting in the scrum of things and maybe making some fairly outrageous statements every once in a while?
I do. I think that, well, first of all, clearly it would be very easy to find out this stuff about Eric Erickson. It's not like he had hidden it.
Yeah, in fact, it's not like it was hidden.
He was on the Colbert Report a few months ago, and Stephen Colbert brought it up, you know, brought up some of the most controversial stuff. So it's nothing that he had hidden. And yeah, I think you're right. I think, I mean, CNN, which I think you would probably think to be the most traditional and newsy of the cable news programs, I think it clearly they have made a determination that they have to be a little bit edgy, and I think that he does provide that. there, mm-hmm. you know, there's no doubt that there are conservative writers and bloggers who are more journalisty, if that's a word. And Eric's definitely an Eric Erickson's definitely an activist blogger, and he's also, you know, someone who uses hyperbole from time to time. So I think that we live in a day and age where controversy sells, and you have to be entertaining as well as educational. And I think that it's sort of mm-hmm. an admission that we are now in that day and age. And CNN, again, I think this is good news for bloggers. I think that whether you're on the left or on the right, you should actually be celebrating this. He's our Rosa Parks. No, I'm joking there. Maybe they're going to use that against me someday when I go for my big CNN spot. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, he's breaking sort of a barrier here for us. And I think that liberal bloggers should probably be applauding him. In the sense that I think that he is breaking a glass ceiling.
Yeah, well, I think, again, you've seen liberal bloggers there. They're all over MSNBC. You know, they're everywhere there. And I know that, you know, if you look on Fox News, there's definitely been the adoption of a lot of conservative bloggers up into the ranks there, and vice versa. You know, obviously these things are somewhat bipartisan. But I agree with you that what's so remarkable is that it's CNN, that it was CNN that decided to take him as a real strong partisan. And I think it's interesting that to a certain extent it demonstrates that CNN is going to try and play, you know, something of a partisan game as well. That the way to sort of stoke controversy and drive viewership is maybe to bring these people into the fold. And I know that Eric Erickson, you know, it's funny because he has been on TV kind of like more. It seems to me that he's been on TV more in the past year than he had been before that. You know, and that could just be my ignorance and my impression.
Definitely true.
Well, yeah, you know, it seems like all of a sudden he was kind of just all over the place.
He lives in Macon, Georgia. So logistically, it's hard for him to get on TV and like for Fox or CNN. For Fox or MSNBC. It's hard for him to get to New York. He did start doing Hannity, and by the way, presumably he will not be able to do Hannity now. So when you're a contributor, you have to stick with the network unless you get a book deal or something, and there's exceptions made.
Right.
But I think that's part of the reason this deal went down. He lives in Macon, so he can drive to Atlanta, where CNN's based, and be face-to-face. So I think that was one of the really good selling points for them to hire him as well, as opposed to someone else, like Michelle Malkin, who's in Colorado Springs, for example.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so who else do you see as kind of like, say that you're like a CNN executive, you know, who else from the conservative blogosphere do you think is going to get picked up and moved and sort of mainstreamed in the same way? Because I think that was one of the interesting things, was they basically mainstreamed him. It wasn't like he was mainstreamed before, at least as far as I know.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's funny. I mean, it just depends what way they're going to go. But there are definitely talented people out there.
Yeah.
It's funny, though. I mean, so, you know, there is this stereotype. Some of the best bloggers I know might not be good on TV. You know what I mean? They're better suited.
A lot of bloggers
they're better suited
aren't good
in their
TV.
Mom's basements and pajamas. Let's just be honest. I mean, there is that blogger thing. And then you have people who are sort of quasi-journalists. Say, like, for example, I write for Politics Daily.
Yeah.
But am I a blogger too? Well, I'm not even really a blogger anymore. I used to be a blogger for townhall.com. I blog at my own site. Then you have people like, you know, Philip Klein in American Spectator. He's on MSNBC a lot. He blogs, but he's also sort of a reporter. David Ferdoso, I saw him on MSNBC today. I think he's with The Examiner now. So they're sort of quasi reporters. But it is interesting, you know, people, you know, there are some good people out there, bloggers on people like Melissa Clothier, who filled in for us here a couple weeks ago. I think she's down south. I don't know if it's Georgia or North Carolina or something like that. Right Wing News, John Hawkins is very good, but I think he's down south. I think he's in North Carolina. So, you know, the people in D.C. or New York tend to be more a little bit more traditional, a little bit more of journalistic bloggers, even the conservatives. And it's the people the people maybe around the country and places that are not Washington, D.C. or New York tend to be the Eric Erickson mold, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's been fascinating because you can just, you know, it's not so far to think that, like, you know, NBC or one of these other even bigger sort of more mainstream morning programs or something will eventually be reaching into the blogosphere, especially, I think, as you see bloggers replacing traditional reporters at big news outlets. So, you know, there's been this great experiment at the New York Times that, like, City Roam, which would have normally been on Metro, is now a blog. And, you know, obviously here we're not talking about, like, partisan blogging, just plain old reported blogging. And I think that you'll see that, you know, that basically, you know, 5 or 10 years from now,
and all reporters are going to be bloggers. I tell you what I think the model is Rick Klein at ABC's The Note. I had him on my podcast recently. He defined himself as, I'm trying to think of the word he used, platform agnostic. He defined himself as platform agnostic, meaning he'll go on television. He'll go on the radio. He could be a broadcaster. He could be a blogger. He used to write for the Boston Globe. I think he's really the model of the future of journalism. But in terms of sort of the punditry part of it, I think that blogging, you know, we've seen in the past, like, say, talk radio hosts get elected to Congress. We've seen, you know, we've seen people like talk radio hosts parlay that into, you know, like Bill Bennett. Obviously, he was also in politics as well in the Reagan administration. But so we've seen sort of people who worked in presidential administrations, whether it's Karl Rove or whomever, parlay it into punditry. We've seen people who are talk radio people become politicians. I think that in the future, in the year 2000, when we're all flying around in in our cars. That fly. I think the bloggers are going to be, you know, the future politicians. You're going to have members of Congress who started off as bloggers. You're going to have, you know, top political analysts and pundits who started off as bloggers, not people who were all.
Yeah.
You know, right now, you have people who are already in the game and then they started a blog in 2007. But I'm talking about people who started off as bloggers, started off. So I just, you know, I envision that world. I'm biased, of course, but that's kind of how I see it shaping up. But what's your take? Am I too optimistic for the future of blogging?
Well, okay, so I think this raises an interesting point that, you know, if you think about, so let's take like a presidential campaign, obviously, where you have somebody, you basically have hundreds of journalists who dig through everything you've ever written, every teacher you've ever had, every person you've ever dated, every house you've ever bought, who has your mortgage, blah, 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 blah. I think that thus far there's been this sort of, you know, you couldn't be a blogger and run for president because you would have said something that would have disqualified you when the blogs then took it up and repeated it endlessly. And sort of, you know, ended your campaign. So that's what I think is, like, sort of interesting about the Eric Erickson thing, is that there's been this sort of, like, you know, this statement that, like, okay, he said some rather nasty things, like, we're over it, we're hiring him because we think he's great. That I think that as you see that sort of, like, more acceptance, not just of blogging as, like, an actual thing that smart people can do to convey smart ideas to a smart populace, but as, you know, a sort of understanding that you're producing a massive volume of commentary on the second, and that maybe you shouldn't be, like, so horribly punished, that would be, like, sort of interesting.
I do.
That, like, having blogging as a biographical thing would not become, you know, just a real liability. Because I can imagine that just about any blogger working today would probably, like, think twice about, like, wanting their entire history to be gone into. But, yeah, I agree with you that I think that the lines have gotten blurrier, that absolutely some of the smartest political commentators I know are bloggers, and that, like, you know, they get higher jobs by the administration and by other folks. And, you know, I think Amanda Carpenter, who you mentioned, you know, now she's working in a major Senate office, and it's not an accident, especially because senators, like, so want to understand how to spin bloggers and how to reach out to them and their constituencies. Because basically I think that blogging, people who get their news from blogging and tweeting, which I basically do, it's because I'm, like, suffused with it anyway. And so I think that you really do see the blogosphere as kind of, like, opinion leading, right? You know, the more and more that it trickles down, I think the more you'll see people, like, spread out into actually running for office and stuff. So I mean, I really agree with you, although I think it might take some time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And that's the great thing about this show is that we agree and it's a place where people who differ on politics can come together in a place of harmony and have a fun and sometimes heated, but often cordial conversation. So, Annie, thank you for being with us today. Tell us again, give us a plug. Where can we find out more about you, and what should we read?
Yeah, so I'm here at Foreign Policy, and I blog at Passport. And actually, a good day for foreign policy bloggers. Tom Ricks won an ASME, American Society of Magazine Editors Award, for his blog, which is on foreign policy. You can come check us out. This site is enormous and expanding and has people who are actually, you know, generally non-ideological and partisan and all sorts of folks here. So I really appreciate it, Matt. It was lots of fun.
It was fun having you. Thank you, and we hope to have you back. And for all of you out there, please tune in next week for The Week in Blog. Thanks.